Hey, welcome to the podcast of Midtown Fellowship 12 South. This is Elliot Cherry, the pastor. And I've said often on Sundays that we don't believe that you've come to church that day, but that if you belong to Jesus, you are the church. See, we believe that it's not our building, but it's our people that most mark this congregation. And yet, our people have brought so much life, joy, and love that our building is now bursting at its seams. And so we're going to embark on a special season together. For 8 weeks in September and October, we're going to celebrate a new vision for our building, our church, and the city of Nashville. And so I'm asking everyone who calls 12 South home, even if you listen from afar, would you join us in this season? If you are in Nashville, would you please come join with us every Sunday during this season to be a part of the legacy that we're living today and shaping for generations to come? If you're interested in learning more, please visit livingalegacycampaign.org to learn more about this vision and how you can be a part of it. Thanks for listening and enjoy the sermon. We're in Judges. Let me give you a brief overview of the book. It's a train wreck book. Judges were these deliverers, these leaders that God raised up to deliver God's people when they were in crisis or in peril by their own making. They kept spiraling out into the same place and then crying out, and Lord will rescue them. And they keep spiraling out and ending up in misery, and the Lord rescues them. And that's kind of the repetition, the downward spiral of the book of Judges over and over again. The theme verse of the book of Judges is the last verse in the book of Judges. It says, in those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So all these individual silos of people, no community, no brotherhood and sisterhood. It's all just individualism everywhere, and the country is a train wreck. That's the summary of the book. Israel needs a king. They don't have a righteous king, and they are doing what's right in their own eyes. So the spiral has begun in our book. Last week, we looked at the first or the second spiral account at which the Lord raises up a judge named Ehud, the left-handed assassin, to come in and free and liberate God's people. And now today is our one and only female judge, Deborah, and she is an incredible leader for God's people in this chapter. It's in Judges chapter 4. Now, before we read this, we're going to read a ton of chapter 4, and then we're going to read a couple verses in chapter 5, because chapter 5 is actually a song. It was a huge hit back in the day that was about chapter 4. It's about the episode that takes place in chapter 4. So we're going to read a large chunk of chapter 4 and then just a couple verses in chapter 5, kind of summarizing. Warning, there's a lot of names. There's a lot of geographical places. They have a purpose, but we're not going to dive into all the name meanings and all that, but just we'll summarize, but just follow along as best as you can. It's also really gruesome, we're about to get into, okay? You're welcome. Here we go. Judges chapter 4, starting in verse 1. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. That was last week's judge. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army, so this is the enemy army, was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he, that's Sisera, had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lappidoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to send her to the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. She sent and summoned Barak, this is like her commander of the armies at the time, the son of Abinom from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go and gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun, and I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand. She's asking, like, the Lord has said this. Like, let's go. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. And she, Deborah, said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory. That's what you want, Barak. But the Lord will sell Sisera, the enemy, into the hand of a woman. And Deborah, so now skipping down to verse 14. So a few other things happen. Skipping down to like now the battle. Okay, we show up at the battle against Sisera and his 900 chariots. And Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. But Sisera, so we got one remaining enemy still alive, fled away on foot to the tent of Jael. Who is this woman? The wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. She's being a great hostess. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him, treating him like royalty. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, is anyone here, say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. You think? And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. Living a legacy. I'm kidding. Here we go. Now skip to chapter 5, verse 24. This is the song written about the episode of chapter 4. We could have read the whole thing, but listen to what they say about Jael, the song, the number one single in that era. "Most blessed of women be Jael." They're praising her. "The wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women, most blessed. He asked for water and she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She sent her hand to the tent peg and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet, he sank, he fell, he lay still. Between her feet, he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead." Verse 31. "So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but your friends be like the sun as he rises in the night." And the land had rest for 40 years. Whoa. Okay, so there's whole articles I could send you, whole like scholarly journal articles written about like the literary masterpiece that this story is. In the original Hebrew, there's so many kind of double entendres and plays on words and the meanings of the characters' names and the irony of it all and the location and the way that, like, where the battles take place and where the tent is. Like, there's all this irony and literary masterpiece going on a few different levels. But the point of Judges is not literary masterpieceness or irony. The point of the book of Judges is showing the people's unfaithfulness and the Lord's continual deliverance of them. So here's what just happened. Let's just recap this for a minute as we walk through it. The next little bit. So we're in the cycle. Israel rebels again against the Lord. They chase after other gods. They get enslaved to a group of people and they get treated cruelly, brutally. And they're now enslaved this round to the king of Canaan. Jabin is his name. And the king of Canaan has his chief commander who's carrying out all of his orders named Sisera. Look at verse 2 and 3. This is telling you about Sisera. "The commander of his army," that's Jabin, the king of Canaan, "was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he," Sisera, "had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Okay, 900 chariots of iron is a flex. Here's what that's telling you. The people of Israel don't stand a chance against this guy. They don't have this technology. They're not a unified nation. They're tribe by tribe. They're trying to muster stuff up together. They don't stand a chance against 900 iron chariots. And this ruler, this commander who is the head of the army of their enemy, is oppressing the people cruelly for 20 years. Life is brutal in Israel yet again, and it's at the hands of this iron chariot army leading commander named Sisera. So the people cry out for deliverance. And the Lord raises up a judge, someone who is already in power, a woman, a leader of God's people, Deborah. And she's here to lead the charge against Sisera. And what she does is she enlists a commander in her tribe, a commander down in kind of South Israel, named Barak. "You need to get your army together, Barak, because the Lord has spoken to me. I'm a prophetess in the land. I'm a leader of the land of our section of Israel. And I need for you to raise up an army. And we're going to go to battle against Sisera. And the Lord has already told me we're going to be victorious. We just got to show up and get our swords and shields out. The Lord has guaranteed this victory. So she calls Barak, has him come to a meeting. We need to get an army together. And look at the second half of verse 6 and verse 7. She said to him, she's like asking, like, hey, you know this. He said this to us, to me. Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 people from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops. And I will give him in your hand. Like the Lord's told us this. We have victory. Get your troops together, Barak, and let's go to battle. She gives him guaranteed victory from the word of the Lord. She's a prophetess in the land. She hears straight from the Lord. I know, it's really sad. Just wait till we get to the nasty part, dude. It's going to be... And look at Barak's response, verse 8. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I'll go. But if you do not go with me, I will not go. So here's what Barak just did. I know the Lord has guaranteed victory. I know that he has promised to give us victory when we go. I heard you say that. I'm not quite so sure about it. If you don't come with me, Deborah, I'm not going. Yahweh assures victory and Barak resists. He won't go unless he has more assurance because he's unsure of the promise that the Lord has already made. It's like Moses in Exodus 3 with the burning bush. Like, Lord calls him to go free his people from slavery in Egypt, and Moses is like, well, I don't really speak so good, so like, I need some more than like this talking burning bush guaranteeing me that this is going to go well. Barak is not convinced. I will not enter the battle unless Debbie comes. Like, I'm not going if she's not with me, which some of that is like, cool, you don't want to do it alone. But you were just told from Deborah herself, the Lord has already guaranteed your victory. The prophet and the judge of God's people at this time has just told you victory is assured and you are unsure. The Bible has a word for this. The Bible has a word for when you hear a clear word from the Lord and you're not quite sure you believe it or you can trust it. It's called doubt. Now, I know the moment I say that word, it sparks something in you, semantics of that word. For the like devoutly religious folks in the room, doubt is like a four-letter word. It's full of shame. How dare you ever not believe in the Lord? You should never doubt anything that he says. Like, the Bible says it, so it's true. Like, what's wrong with you that you have any doubt? That's one camp. And then the spectrum goes to the whole other side of the room, which is kind of the secular elite that think you should doubt everything. Like, nothing can be trusted, and I don't trust anything except myself. And then everything in between, our experience with that word. And spiritual doubt, like, stays out of those two poles of, like, you should never doubt, doubt is the worst, and you should doubt everything all the time. It stays out of those extremes. Spiritual doubt is this normal experience for God's people, and it's this. It's what happens when your experience in life or your mind do not make the words of the Lord seem true. So that space, that tension where those two things collide, your experiences in your mind don't seem to prove to you that what God has said is actually true. And that experience, in that tension where like, this is not lining up, can be incredibly disorienting. Doubt can make you feel like you're losing your foothold, like you've lost your balance. It feels like vertigo, spiritual vertigo. And dizziness. One of the Greek words for doubt in the New Testament actually speaks to that experience of the disorientation. One of the Greek words in the New Testament for doubt is dipsychos. Two psyches is a word for doubt. Like, I've got two psyches going on. Like, I feel divided. I can't tell which is clear and which is real. And if you've ever had like double vision, which is kind of what it's talking about, spiritual double vision, dipsychos. If you've ever had actual double vision and you try to walk, like, I can't see the curb right there. Is that a step or is that firm ground? I can't tell where to go because I don't trust what I see. Is what I see, like, my brain is not transmitting the image clearly enough for me to know, can I trust this thing? So you have a lot of shakiness in doubt because there's uncertainty in doubt, spiritual uncertainty. And when you lose a certainty, like when you have clear vision and then you go to double vision, it's incredibly disorienting, right? It's like, wait, I used to see clearly and now I don't feel like right now I can. What's happening? And here's what you need to know. The people of God have had doubts since the beginning of time. Like since the garden. Doubt was in the garden. It's what Satan comes to Eve to say to confirm something for her. Did God really say, like, I know what you thought you heard. I know you had one vision of clarity, but did God really say that? That's doubt's favorite phrase. Did God really say? That's the summary of doubt. Did God really say? So you can doubt anything. We typically think about doubt as something that, like, you doubt the historical reliability of the resurrection of Jesus. And that's fine. Plenty of people do doubt that, and understandably so. It's a hard thing to come to believe. But doubt does not only relate to the historical reliability of the claims of our faith or of Scripture. Doubt, you can doubt anything, did God really say. You can doubt, did Jesus actually rise from the dead? Or you can doubt, does God actually love me? Like, does he actually call me his own? Do I actually belong to him? He says I do, but my experience and my mind are telling me maybe that's not true. Or like Barak, you can doubt that God is actually telling you the truth. Doubts are a normal part of walking with the Lord, and double vision is hard. It's really hard to get certainty and clarity when you can't see clearly. But here's the kicker. Here's what this story shows us about the experience of doubt. Barak doubts what Yahweh can do. And that doesn't stop Yahweh, the Lord, from actually delivering his people. Barak's doubts don't change what the Lord does for his people. Look at what the Lord does in spite of Barak's resistance and doubt. Verse 14 and 15. And Deborah said to Barak, this is like the day of the battle. We fast forward a little bit from his doubt. Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? So Barak went down. I love that. He's not sure he believes it, but he goes. Went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera, like Vandy yesterday against Alcorn State, just routed him, okay? It's the only time I've ever been able to say that. Vandy routed somebody. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. The Lord routed Sisera. Like, he didn't leave one alive, all those 900 chariots. He decimates them. He so overwhelms and destroys the 900 chariots of iron that this is some of the, like, literary masterpieceness of this. Now the chariot king, the chariot man of the land, is now fleeing on foot. Do you see the irony? He's been reduced to the absurd. That's what the author's showing you. He's alive, but he's lost all of his power. And now he's fleeing on foot. He's gone from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the valley. But before we see how Sisera ends up, we'll get to that in a minute. Please don't miss this reality of the tension between doubt and faith. Do you know in the infamous Hebrews 11 New Testament chapter, the Hall of Faith? Which is like a list of all these Old Testament saints that are listed in like this Hall of Fame of Faith, the Hall of Faith. Barak is listed. Just one word where the author of Hebrews says, and I don't have time to talk about all these other ones, and Barak is one of them. It's like, wait. Barak didn't have faith. He had doubt. He wasn't sure. Why is he a hero of the faith? Because this is what you would find if you studied any of the people in Hebrews 11. That it's not about the amount of faith that one has. It's about who they trusted in, even when they weren't quite sure if they believed it at all. It's been said before, but merit saying again, it's the object of your faith that matters, not the amount of it. It's the object of your faith that matters, not the amount of it. That's why a mustard seed can move mountains and move hearts, things that seem impossible to move. Impossible tasks accomplished with the smallest amount of faith, because it's not about the amount of faith you have, it's about the object of the little faith that you do have. What object is that in? Impossible tasks being accomplished with the smallest amount of faith. Hashtag capital campaign. Like, we're here in faith. Seems impossible. How in the world could this all happen? I don't know. We're just walking by faith where we believe the Lord has led us. But here's the point. Just because you don't believe it fully will not stop the Lord from acting on your behalf. That's what the story shows. Because that's who the Lord is. So if you hear nothing else this morning, please hear this. The Lord does not need your faith in order to save you and deliver you. He doesn't need it because he doesn't need anything. He is totally self-sufficient within himself. He is not waiting on you to like level up to level 10 faith to then he can finally come and act for you and defend you and deliver you and save you and redeem you. That's not how he works. He's not sitting there tapping his foot thinking, if you would just get your faith act together, do you know how much power I could show you? Do you know what I could do for you if you would just believe in me more? That's not who he is. That's not the story of the Bible. That's not what the relationship between faith and doubt and the Lord is. He's not waiting for you to muster up faith before he comes and delivers you. Because he doesn't need your faith in order to work or save you. So here's the invitation from Barak in this story. Would you risk, like he did, walking in faith and believing what the Lord has said to you and about you through his word, even if you're not quite sure you believe it? Because you realize like your life would look remarkably different if the little bit of mustard seed of faith that you weren't quite sure you believe, but I'll cling on to it with everything that I've got, if you believe like the Lord had actually washed you white as snow and he wasn't holding your past sins against you anymore. Do you realize if you believed that, like trusted that it was true and walked in that, like Barak did, like, I don't really think we're gonna be these chariots, but I'll show up to battle. Like, I don't really have it. Like, what if you risked walking in believing what the Lord says to be true, even if you're not quite sure you believe it? What if you risked walking in believing the Lord, not for one day since the history of time, has never left the throne? He's still seated on the throne. He's still ruling. He's still overruling. It is not chaotic for him. Doesn't feel like that. Your experience and your mind aren't going to tell you that those things are true. Would you risk believing it, even with just a little bit of faith? Would you risk walking like Barak did in believing what the Lord has said, even if you're not quite sure you believe it? But that's not the end of the story. Barak's victory in battle at the hands of the Lord routing them, is not the end of the story. The story isn't over after the chariots get destroyed because the final enemy hasn't been defeated yet. The cruel master of God's people is still on the run, Sisera. And the Lord promised in verse 8, not only would he defeat the army, but he's going to give Sisera into the hands of a woman. That hasn't come true yet. So the story's not over. Can't be over. And when we hear the promise that Sisera is going to fall at the hand of a woman, every reader and every character in the story thought, well, that's going to be Deborah. She's the mightiest woman in the land. It's going to be her. And then deliverance comes from a totally unexpected place. Jael. This largely unknown woman. She's the wife of Heber the Kenite, which is this kind of neutral tribesman. They actually descend from Moses' in-laws in the like Moab desert. We don't know a whole lot about these people, but they're kind of neutral. They kind of play both sides. They've been in relationship with the Israelites and with the Canaanites, but they're neutral. And so Sisera, the general, is on the run, and if you could see it on a map, you would see like he's far from the battle. He's run for a long time by foot, and he shows up at this tent, and Jael invites him in. We don't know much about her, but we know this. She is smoother than James Bond and Jason Bourne. I know that. Or like, who's a spy today? Like, what's like a spy for like the current generation? Like Harriet the Spy or somebody? Like, are there no spies anymore? Do they not do spies for, cool. We'll go with Bond or Bourne. We'll go with JL. She's the original. So Sisera comes to her, this neutral woman in her tent, out kind of in the wilderness, like not close to where the battle was. And he thinks he's found safekeeping. And so JL, this master assassin, you never expect it, says in verse 18 and 19, Sisera comes to her. He thinks he's safe. Turn aside, my lord. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid. So he turned aside to her into the tent. And she covered him with a rug. What a great ancient Near East host she's being. And he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. She doesn't give him water. She treats him like royalty. She opened up a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him, tucked him in, sang him a lullaby. Like, oh, there. Let's just go to sleep now. She lures the enemy in so smoothly. Don't be afraid. You want water? I'll give you milk. You need a blanket? Yes, have my bed. Come and sleep. You're safe. So Sisera falls asleep, and then verse 21. Let's read it again in case you missed it the first time. But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. Whoa. JL, thank you, narrator, for the detail of just how far the tent peg had to go in to like pin his brain to the ground. Tent peg in the temple for the abuser of God's people. A little bit of wonderful trivia I found out this week. I loved learning this week. Shared it with Daryl, and he's like, you're going to say that on Sunday, aren't you? I'm like, heck yeah, I am. The people got to know. JL was part of Tolkien's inspiration for Eowyn, Theoden's niece, like the Rohan warrior woman who like goes in disguise into battle and then like slays the Lord of the Nazgul, right? Like, how does she do it? Like, through his face. You know, I am no man. That scene, isn't it awesome? And like, he took from this story, is like, JL needs to make it in Lord of the Rings. It's amazing. And I know it's gruesome and I know it's intense and we're not like promoting violence here. This is not like a, hey, go be like JL and do this. That's not what it's about. But please do note what the Bible says about her and her act. Chapter 5, it's why we read it, 5:24. The Bible holds her up as a hero. This outsider who delivers Israel that no one thought, like, where is deliverance going to come from? This outsider woman. Chapter 5:24, most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women, most blessed. She's praised. She delivers Israel. She defeats the enemy. And then if you kept reading in chapter 5, verse 27, verse 31, it says, so may all your enemies be, O Lord. Like, we long for you to do this to all the enemies of God and God's people. And so what JL is showing is, this is just a little picture. I know it's gruesome, but it's just a little picture of what God does to his enemies. And I know that some of you would love for the Lord to defeat the enemies of your life like this too. Like, Lord, this is awesome. Would you take away all of my despair and depression and drive a tent peg through it? Would you defeat my relationship with my body image? It just gnaws at me and it eats at me and it's tormenting me cruelly. Why don't you do this to the enemies of my life, God? But maybe the Lord hasn't defeated your despair or your addiction today, but he has defeated the enemy, the real enemy that's behind all those things. Like, what if you and he have a different definition of who your Siseras are? Like, you've got a list of things that you would like for him to defeat and destroy like this, but he's actually got a different definition of who your greatest enemy is. See, this has kind of always been the deal with God's people and their stated enemies. That they have these enemies and they need the Lord to deliver them, and then he does, and in the Old Testament he does, and then it turns out they're still tormented by a different enemy within. This happens in Egypt. Moses delivers them from the Egyptians under Pharaoh's hand, and they're like, we're finally free. We're finally a free people. No more Pharaoh's thumb oppressing us, enslaving us for 400 years. It's over. And then they get in the wilderness, and they're miserable still because their real enemy wasn't Pharaoh. Now, they needed to be freed, but the real enemy was not Pharaoh. It was sin and death, which was still with them. And so please hear this. Your greatest enemy is not your marriage, it's sin and death. Your greatest enemy is not your anxiety, it's sin and death. It's not this culture, it's not who's in the Oval Office, it's not your boss, it's not your physical ailment. Your greatest enemy is sin and death. And because of Jesus, just like Sisera here, your enemy, sin and death, has lost all of their chariots. Like, they have no more power anymore. He's lost everything. Sin and death has lost everything that made them powerful. They have been reduced to the absurd. Their chariots are gone. The work of Jesus is finished. He has fully defeated the power of sin and death. Much like Sisera, Okay, think about this now. Like the brief timeline of this battle where like Sisera lost all his power, but he wasn't dead yet. He was still on the run. We're in the same tension. Like our enemy, our greatest enemy has been defeated. It is finished. But the enemy hasn't quite been slain yet. But he lost all his power. There is no power in the hands of sin and death anymore because Jesus has defeated them, but he's still running around. It's like the dragon's been slayed, but his tail still wags a bit. He's lost all his chariots. We're just awaiting the day when Jesus, the better JL, will fully and finally put a tent peg through the temple of our abuser. That's what we're waiting on. And I know that sounds intense, but that's what 1 Corinthians 15 says, like the greatest chapter written on the resurrection in the whole Bible. Like what it means for us victoriously, what it means for Christ and his enemies. Jesus has defeated all his enemies. The war is over, but death still lingers. He doesn't have any power. It's like Sisera running, thinking that he's got power still. He doesn't have any power. And so 1 Corinthians 15 says, they've been defeated. Sin and death have been defeated. They have no more power, but they're still lingering. And so one day when Jesus returns victoriously, he will defeat all of his enemies. And the last enemy to be fully and finally defeated will be death itself. This will be when Jesus returns to put all of his enemies under his feet and use them like a footstool, and he will deliver death its final death blow. The last enemy to be defeated will be death. And you thought Harry Potter's parents put that on their tombstone and they were original. They stole it from Paul. Paul was talking about when Jesus returns to put a tent peg of justice in the temple of death. Or in the words of some of my favorite theologians, Coldplay, one day death and all his friends will be finally decimated. He's already lost his chariots. He's already lost his power. But here's what that means. Because sin and death have lost their power, currently, right now, a victorious King Jesus is holding the scepter that rules the world. Which means that in this lingering state, like Sisera's lost all of his chariots, but he hasn't been fully defeated yet. In this in-between state, there are still real things right now that hurt. Death and sorrow and anguish and war and cancer and betrayal. All those things are real. But they also have an expiration day. And see, sin right now, death right now is telling you, it's writing a story for you that is trying to convince you that they still have power over you. They don't. It's kind of like, we read it, but we didn't talk about it. It's kind of like when Sisera's in the tent. He has no power. All of his army has been defeated by the Lord, but he's in the tent still acting like he's got power. Hey, JL, let me order you around. Let me tell you what you're going to do for me in the tent. It's like, dude, you don't have any power? You're acting like you got power. You don't have any power. But Jesus, the better JL, is telling you a different story. Not only do sin and death not win in the end, but Jesus is coming back, and so that means Jesus one day will have the final word on how this world ends, not sin and death. Meaning one day you won't wonder anymore if anyone wants you. One day your body won't carry any of its trauma anymore. You'll get a new body. One day all of your relationships will be without strife. One day you won't say goodbye to anyone too soon. One day there will be no more massacres, no more wars, no more hatred, no more strife. One day, the things that keep you up at night won't keep you up at night anymore because there will be no more night. One day. And one day your doubts, your like spiritual double vision, your darkness, your fog will mist away. And you'll have clear vision and you'll behold the King. You won't wonder anymore. At the end of the darkness, you'll burn your chains up and you will be free. That day is coming when Jesus returns to deliver death, the final death blow. Let's sing and close together. Jesus, what a gruesome story to even begin to bump into that would, how could it possibly deliver us hope? We've got this spiritual double vision. We've got this dipsychos that makes things really unclear sometimes, Lord. And I pray that for just a few moments this morning, we would have single vision. We would have clarity on, oh, this is who you are and this is what you do to your enemies. You send unexpected saviors to destroy those that abuse your people. You've already done it in Jesus. So give us just a mustard seed of faith this morning to rest in that, to sing out to that and believe that one day the mist will be gone. And you will be with us and we will be with you forevermore. May we leave here rejoicing because of this reality. In your name, amen.